The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi, everyone. Good evening, and welcome to the Free Library. My name is Michelle Saracini. I'm the assistant here for the Author Events Program, and I'm really, really excited to be introducing our author to you tonight. Before we begin, just a couple of quick things. Please make sure that your cell phones are off. And also, after the program, there will be a book signing upstairs in the lobby. And I wanted to let you know that Ms. Lamott, she'll be signing, but she won't be doing any personalizations tonight. Okay. Anne Lamott's writing is thoughtful, touching, witty, and kind. She blends respect and irreverence, timidity and confidence, and a whole host of other black and white opposites into shades of poignant gray in her essays and novels. Her ruminations on faith in the bestsellers Traveling Mercies, Plan B, and Grace Eventually, for which she appears here tonight, are refreshingly honest. As she writes, I find God in the utter dailiness and messiness of it all. I'm also sure there are many writers in the audience here tonight, and I'm sure that they could probably quote lengthy passages from her seminal Bird by Bird. You don't want to get me started. I attended writing classes as a kid, I studied it in college, but I have to say that the most inspiring thing I've ever heard anyone say about the act or even notion of writing came from Bird by Bird. I quote Ms. Lamott, for me and other writers I know, writing is not rapturous. In fact, the only way I can get anything written at all is to write really, really shitty first drafts. So please join me in welcoming Ms. Lamott.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here. My friends, the Guerreras, came up, and I'm really excited to see them. And I'm sick. I have terrible health issues and deteriorating health. Actually, I just have a cold and really, really sore throat. But it's a little better, and I have hot tea. And I love being in Philadelphia. I'm so excited to be at the library. And I'm really glad to take questions and to answer anything at all you want to ask about writing or faith or really anything. I hate personalizing. I just hate it. And about 5 years ago, I decided I would stop. And I get arthritis in my hand, too. And if I sign my name, you can sign your name till the cows come home, and it won't hurt because your body's just so used to it. You know, Jimmy Carter can sign his name 2,000 times in 1 hour. So, I mean, it's a gift. So, but I hate it, and my hand would, and I also hate it. Is that Diane with two N's or one N? And, oh, are you Ann with an E? And then we'd have to talk about how we feel about the Ann's without E's and, or it would be an N with an E, or without an E, and it would be awkward because I would have just said something. And so I was just going to stop doing events was my solution. And then my lecture agent said, well, you could stop personalizing. And I thought, oh, no, people would think you were so awful and snobby if you didn't. And they said, no, they won't. They won't think that at all. And so my position is you can write anything you want, and I will sign it. And I have signed everything that you can possibly imagine. Now, I have made a commitment to the Guerreras, who have a long drive home, to really keep this to about an hour or so. And I'm glad to stay afterward and sign whatever you brought. I'll sign other people's books. I will sign as many books. I'll sign old books. I'll sign books you've dropped in the bathtub. Writers love really yellowed pages and dog-eared books. It means just great. It's the greatest thing. So I think I'll just start by reading something. There's a short library piece that I might save. If I can save 10 minutes to the end, I'll read that too, because I really believe in libraries as sacred space, as sacred as cathedrals or chapels or mountains, you know, and we have this governor. Oh, don't even get me started. I'm from California. And it's been a challenge for my tiny princess self. And I wrote a little story about his decision a couple summers ago to close two public libraries in the poorest county in California, Salinas County, that you are probably most familiar with from John Steinbeck, famously. And so anyway, I'll read you. I will save 10 minutes, and I'll just read you a piece I sort of like that I actually am reading because I think the Guerrera kids will like it. So that is my – it's the first piece in here anyway. This is the third collection of essays on spirituality. Oh, there's a bunch of people in some overflow room that we can all feel better than because they're in the overflow room because they got in on this late. But there are certain things I'm supposed to observe that have to do with there being an overflow room. Oh, I know what it is. If you ask a question, you have to wait for the mic. So the chronically late people in the overflow room will hear your questions. And we love them, don't we, in the overflow room. And we don't judge them. Yes. Okay, this is called Ski Patrol. There's not much truth being told in the world. There never was. This has proven to be a major disappointment to some of us. When I was a child, I thought grown-ups and teachers knew the truth because they told me they did. It took years for me to discover that the first step in finding out the truth is to begin unlearning almost everything. Oh, wait a second. This is the wrong section. Sorry. A little slip up. I have a little jet lag besides my deteriorating health. I thought it didn't sound familiar. Okay. Ski Patrol. See, all those people in the overflow room are rolling their eyes and smirking now that I made a big mistake. Ski Patrol. Not too long ago, I was skiing in the mountains where my son Sam and I spend a weekend most winters. Nowadays, he instantly disappears with the hordes of snowboarders. I believe he is somewhat embarrassed to be seen with me. Once, standing next to him and his friend at the bottom of a hill, I fell over for no reason. And in fact, the very first time we went skiing together, I skied in a strangely slow, inexorable path for 100 feet or so, straight into a huge net at the bottom of the slopes, erected to protect the small ski bear children from being crushed by people like me. Then I got all tangled up in it like a fish. After Sam disappears, I usually take the chairlift to the top of the pony slope for a couple of runs, which anyone can manage, and I triumph. I roar down the slight incline, pretending to be an Olympic skier. Filled with confidence, I try the easiest intermediate slope, where I mostly fall or slide down on my butt for the first run, and then have a few extended runs of 4 or 5 minutes where I'm actually skiing. By my second run down an intermediate slope, I am on my feet almost the whole time, skiing triumphantly for America. But this time, as the chairlift carried me to the top of the intermediate slope, which I had just skied down, I experienced a moment's confusion, born of hormones, high altitude, and a light snow falling. I suddenly could not remember whether the stop we were approaching was the same one I had just skied down from. The chair slowed and lowered for us to disembark, and my seatmate got off and zipped away like a swallow, while I sat there torn between wanting to get off and thinking mine was the next stop. The chair jerked forward and resumed its ascent. I looked around for landmarks, but saw only brightly colored skiers and clusters, and I was pretty sure that this was not the right stop. Until a second later, when I realized I was mistaken, it was the right stop. By then, the chair was 4 or 5 feet off the ground and rising, But I did not let this stop me. I took a long, deep breath, wriggled to the edge of the chair, and flung myself into the snow. Flung myself the way stuntmen fling themselves onto the backs of speeding trains, or a clown flings himself from a bucking bronco, mugging bug-eyed for the crowd. I estimate that I was 5 or 6 feet off the ground for the timeless instant of eternity before I crashed down into the snow. I landed hard, proving the theory of gravity once and for all. I was somehow still on my skis for a moment until I fell over. I do not imagine anyone had ever seen anything quite like this before. Someone hurtling into outer space with such force from such a low starting point. I felt like Icarus near death in the snow, with melting skis instead of wings. I was immediately aware of two things, that I was not badly hurt, and that most people were pretending not to have noticed. Out of kindness or horror or mortification, I am ever my mother's daughter, and so my first impulse was to smile with confidence to the few who were watching. Wave like a politician campaigning from a rarely used horizontal position. I'm okay, I said to the two pretty women who came over and offered to pull me up. I continued to wave nonchalantly, as if this sort of silly thing happened to me all the time. I told them I just needed to catch my breath. They made sympathetic cooing sounds and skied away. I sat up and leaned back on my hands in the snow. By the time I finally stood up, my hands were frozen. I was winded, ashamed, confused, and bruised, grateful only that Sam hadn't seen me. He would have died. He would have stabbed himself repeatedly in the head with his ski pole. Just when I thought things couldn't get much worse, nausea struck, wave after wave, like morning sickness. And I thought, I'm going to throw up now in the snow. Ladies and gentlemen, for my next trick, I pretended to pinch my nostrils against the cold, but was actually pressing my hand to my mouth to hold back the tide. My head spun and I prayed, help me, Jesus, help me. The way one very old woman at my church named Mary Williams used to pray at her most afraid and delirious, right in the middle of anything, sermons, songs, prayers. She'd cry, I know my change is going to come. Touch me now, Lord. I don't know how long I stood there with my hand clamped to my mouth, only my poles and afraid consignment store faith to support me. All I knew was that help is always on the way, 100% of the time. Rumi said, someone fills the cup in front of us. I know that when I call out, God will be near and hear and help eventually. Of course, it is the eventually that throws one into despair. For instance, even now I know America will be restored again, eventually. Although it is hard to envision this at the moment. And it could take a century or more for the nation and world to recover from the last few years. But they will. God always hears our cries and helps. And it is always a surprise to see what form God will take on earth. In the old joke, a man whose plane crashed in the tundra bitterly tells a bartender that God forsook him, that he waited in vain for divine intervention and would have died in the snow if it hadn't been for some fucking Eskimos who came by. It's common in recovery for people to refer to various Eskimos. So they'll say, you've been an Eskimo for me, or they'll say, that waitress at Denny's, I tell you, I was at the end of my rope and she was an Eskimo. So maybe a tall, strong man with a medical toboggan would be by soon. Or the two pretty women. Or Jesus and earmuffs. Instead, a short, plump woman pulled up on skis a few minutes later. She was wearing an orange cap and an official jacket from the ski resort. "I think I'm going to throw up," I said, so she wouldn't get too close. "Well, then, let's just stand here a moment," she said. She had acne and chapped cheeks and small brown eyes. "I think I might need some help," I said, which is something I force myself to say every few years. "Boy, you landed so hard. I saw you from up above." "Great." I shook my head, bewildered and on the verge of tears. "Are you on the ski patrol?" I asked. "Sort of. I'm here to help in non-emergency situations like this. Why don't you come with me?" She stepped out of her skis and stood on my binding so that I could step out of mine. We picked up our skis and I trudged after her through the snow. I have cough drops in my pocket. I could do a kind of clicking reading. Hold on. I think if I just sucked on this cough drop for a minute or so, I would be better. And I'm sorry. I should have brought something to entertain you with. I could dance. My boyfriend and I take my ballroom dancing now, which I'll tell you about if anyone wants to know afterwards. But you all look so cute. I'm glad you're here. Okay. It's kind of disgusting, but I don't know what choices I have. I have this new symptom of being middle-aged, which is I get that kind of runny old lady eye. Sometimes I get it in the cold. It's so embarrassing. God, I'm just a mess. Okay. We picked up our skis and I trudged after her through the snow. We walked to a wooden 10-by-10 shack away from the lift and went inside. It held two long benches, a folding chair, and shelves laden with first aid equipment, bottles of water, used coffee cups, a walkie-talkie, and it was warm from a kerosene heater. There were two shabby windows through which you could see snowy pine trees outside. The woman poured me a miniature Dixie cup of water, but my face was so cold that I couldn't get my lips to work, and I dribbled water down my front like an aged, numbed-up person at the dentist's office. She took the cup away from me. "Let's take off your gloves first," she said, and pulled them off as gently as if they were mittens connected inside my jacket sleeve with a string. She laid my gloves on the chair near the heater and pulled off her own. "Mine are nice and toasty," she said. "You can wear them for a while until yours warm up." "I'll be back soon. There are only a couple of us working this spot today." She went outside. After a while, I stretched out on one of the benches and closed my eyes. The kerosene smelled like lacquer, and I kept feeling waves of nausea. My bones were cold. I could isolate the icy scent of pine trees that sneaked through the walls. Sometimes grace is a ribbon of mountain air that gets in through the cracks. I practiced concentrating between each wave of nausea the way I did when I was in labor, savoring ice chips and apple juice between contractions. Miles from home, holed up deeply alone in a smelly hut, I had that old familiar feeling of separation from myself, from God, and from the happy, pretty people outside. I thought of the woman from the ski patrol with her small brown eyes. She looked like the monk seals that swim ashore in Hawaii to rest on the sand. The adult seals are 6 feet long, and they all look like Charles Lawton. The newest tourists on the beach think they are dying and need to be rescued. But anyone who has even been there a day knows that they come on shore to rest. Pool workers from the beachside resorts always arrive with yellow safety tape and traffic cones to rope off a space for the seals to rest in. The first time I came upon one in the sand, I thought it was trying to make eye contact with me. I thought I might be its last best hope of being saved. It had sand around its eyes and lots of shark scars. My guy Rory, who surfs in Hawaii every year, laughed and explained that the seals are perfectly fine, and when they are rested, they waddle back to the ocean. This is how I feel about the world much of the time, when I'm not feeling so far gone. Things are how they are supposed to be, all evidence to the contrary. Life swims for a while, lumbers across the sand, rests. Lumbers, swims, rests. I lay there on the beach, immobilized. If I were a monk seal, I could have waddled up into a sitting position, slid off the bench, and pulled myself by my flippers back into the ocean. Rory once saw a mother monk seal teaching her pup how to rest by swimming up on the sand for a while before slipping back into the waves. The two of them practiced over and over, then disappeared into the water. Remembering this made me miss Sam terribly. I felt discarded, and I needed for time to pass more quickly. I would be fine with life's contractions if they would simply pass when I am ready for them to, so I can be okay again and remember what, after all, I'm doing in labor. Being human can be so dispiriting. It's a real stretch for me half the time. I put my nose to a crack in the wall so I could smell the pine. I couldn't wait any longer for the ski patrol woman to come back. Where was she? She'd said. She was my only real friend, and I was such a mess. Her voice was gentle and kind. The psalmist wrote, "Oh, that today you would hearken to his voice and harden not your hearts." "Okay, fine," I said to God, and then noticed that I was less of a frozen mess than I'd been earlier. This was a lot. I could have sat up, but I wanted the ski patrol person to see the full extent of my suffering, if she in fact ever returned. I thought of the people I know from church and political circles who are doing a kind of psychic ski patrol in the world, noticing when people are in trouble, refusing to look away, offering an ear and their own warm gloves to wear. 20 minutes later, my ski patrol woman did come back, rubbing her hands together. "How you doing?" she asked. At first, the enthusiasm in her voice worried me because she sounded as if we might now move on to calisthenics. Then I could tell that she knew I was fine, better, and rested. I was peaceful. She was my own private pool worker, my own mother seal. I sat up and breathed in the fresh air from the open door. She gave me another Dixie cup of water, and I hoisted this one Germanically. She walked over to the heater and checked my gloves. They're all ready to wear again if you'll give me mine back. I stood up. I felt like my old self, which is to say creaky, but okay. "I'd take the chair down," she said, "unless you really want to ski." I really wanted to ski. I'd already had one great run down this slope. She made a huge fuss over me when I left, as if I'd been in an avalanche or something. I pulled on my gloves and headed out onto the huge white ocean of ice. I glided and fell and got back up and skied little by little, the very best I could, all the way down the mountain. I'm very glad if you have a question. Otherwise, I can just answer something of my own. Try to imagine what... Oh, there's a question. Yes, sir. You have to wait for the mic because of the people in the overflow room. But here comes someone. You can be the very first person. Here he is.
Did you ever get money or acknowledgement from the people who produce Snakes on the Plane?
Did I ever get money or acknowledgments from people who produce Snakes on Planes? I didn't, but why would I?
There was a great sentence in one of your short stories about being on a plane.
Oh, that's right, from Traveling
Mercy.
Where
you said, I hope that the snakes don't escape from the cargo hold.
Yeah.
And that's the movie.
That's right. I'm pathologically afraid of snakes. I had an older brother, and for some reason that I haven't quite figured out, he used to toss snakes at me. He put them down my sunsuit. And in the 50s, we had these little sunsuits with elastic around the tummy, and then they all tied here, and he'd drop them down, and they go past the elastic. And I never bounced back. And I don't even like to think of snakes. I mean, just this is like a huge stretch for me. But, yeah, I did write a piece in Traveling Mercy about how every single thing on this one plane went wrong. It was just, I mean, it got some people changed their mind after we were out on the tarmac and decided to go back. And so we had to go back. And then we had to take out their suitcases, and which took about an hour and a half in case they were, you know, had bombs on board. And this was in 1995 or something. I mean, it went on. Somebody had a heart attack, but they were fine. I mean, it was like unbelievable. And I just kept worrying that there were going to be snakes in the cargo hold, and that the next thing you knew, they were going to get out. But my favorite thing about that movie, which I, of course, didn't see, oh, my God, was I saw an interview with Samuel L. Jackson, and he said, normally when you do a movie, you find out who the package is, who the other actors are, and the producer and the director, of course, and you want to see a script. But he said, that one, I just heard the title, and I said, I am so in. So, okay, so I'll ask a question while somebody thinks of something. You probably want to know how Sam is doing. Yes, because I do this, and people always want to know how Sam is, because my first book was a journal of Sam's first year called Operating Instructions, and on it he's photographed in a Mervyn's tiger suit, and about 8 or 9 months old. And so people will see me, and they'll say, God, Sam must be a teenager by now. And he's 18 and a half. He's a young man. He's grown up, and he's living on his own with his girlfriend and working construction. And he's mostly great, mostly just lovely and very sweet and sensitive. And he's very fair. His fifth grade teacher said he was the fairest student she had ever come upon, and she was very old. And I said, couldn't you grade for that? Because other things were harder for him, almost everything. I said, couldn't you just give him an A in fairness? And he's really good with his hands. I'm like very intellectual and cerebral, and there's kind of this endless ticker tape of thoughts and ideas and metaphors and images, or things I just remembered, or things I overheard in the express line at Safeway. He's not that way. He's articulate, but he's got the gift in his hands that some of you have, or have kids who have this, where he can create, but he can also invent, because he can see the other sides of things that don't show yet. Like he can see the far side underneath of a pyramid, and he could just see it. And so he can start to work with that, because he sees his intelligence is spatial, or encompasses spatial understanding, which not me. I didn't get it from me. So that's how he is. He's really well. I love 18 and a half. 17, hard. Yes, here's a question in the third row with a red tie.
My question is, kind of goes with talking about being a mother, and in Grace Eventually, you write about, you write about addiction a lot, but then you write that a mother's addiction can sometimes be worry.
Mm-hmm.
And you write so well about putting off addiction and sort of fighting it. How would you, I don't know, can you say something about like putting off the addiction to worry, if in case someone... Not
you
saying
mean if you have the addiction, yeah, to worry, how to stop
I'm not
it?
Saying I do, but I'm just saying.
No, I'm sure. No. All of us here think you're fine. And about half of the overflow people, too. What I wrote about, I've had every single major addiction you can have. except gambling, which is a big yet for me. And but I love dollar bill machines. I love them at the car wash, and I love them when I used to do the laundry. I love for the quarters to come out. But everything else that you would know about to be addicted to, I have been. And really hardest of all was to get over the addiction to obsessing about other people and to obsessing about how other people were doing as a way of medicating myself. It's called codependence, but it's also called other things, and it's life-threatening. A lot of people die because they don't get the care they need, because they calm themselves and fill themselves with value by being a flight attendant to the whole world, and by being medic supply, and by being the launderer, and by being the just being so good and having so few needs. My position is that if you are over the age of 12 years old and you're an American female and you're not really angry, then you've missed the boat. And we should talk afterwards. But just a minute, you can be next, but I'm not finished up here yet. And do you see that person back there? Yeah, she's going to be there. The need to be good, to be the good, I was like the seriously goodest girl, literally in the history of California. And I was a high achiever, and I did really well, and I was so incredibly good to people, to everyone, but especially to men, because that was where, before the women's movement, all value arose, was your value, your currency when it came to men with power. And to try to learn that hit you get when you impress or seduce or please or really bail out a man is going to be really temporary, and it's not going to fill the God-shaped hole. And in fact, that's going to make the hole bigger. It was the hardest work I've ever had to do. The hardest work I had to do was to learn to stay on my own emotional acre, because what I like to do is to come on to yours and to help. I'm addicted to helping you. I like to help people. And what I like to do is to help people in trouble. And I come onto their acres with them, and I start cleaning things up, and I bring hefty bags with me. They're just doing their life, you know. They're learning who they are. They're learning what it means to be human. They're having relationships. Some of them are failing. They're developing their creative lives, or they're shutting down, or they're reading, or they're doing whatever. And often I discovered that when I arrived on people's emotional acres with my hefty bags, there was conflict. There was unhappiness. And my solution was not to learn to stay off of their acres. It was to help better and to figure out how to help them in a way that would make them happy. So maybe instead of a hefty bag, I would bring seeds and bulbs, because we could plant. And things would be certainly more cheery when the bulbs came up. Or I would bring food because the person wasn't, I thought, eating properly. Or I would come because they were so lonely and they wouldn't go out. And so instead of letting them experience their choice not to go out, I would join them and entertain and listen and coach. So as a parent, I have to say that the worry was huge in me, because you're just so unprepared for how desperately and deeply you love the child. As soon as you know you're pregnant, really, but certainly as soon as you see them, you're just doomed. It's all over. You're never going to have a complacent week again as long as you live. And I don't think it's hard for everybody, but it's hard for those of us who are addicted to help and to saving and to rescuing. And so, you know, it's sort of easy when you can see them and then you only worry about them. And when they hold hands with you and you only worry about them, you know, being stolen by pedophiles and hit by cars. Or I was always worried that a rogue wave in Mexico would get Sam or something like that. But then they become teenagers, and it's just so dicey. Once they start driving, it's all over. And the way that I know that helps is to tell the truth about it. I'd give you a cough drop, but I only have the one. Like with almost everything else I know, as soon as you say it out loud to somebody who you can trust, a very safe person, I worry excessively about this. And I think it's very injurious to the person. I'm having old lady weepy eyes now. Oh, I hate this. I hate being sick. It's so embarrassing. But I know you understand that I don't have any choice. And you say it out loud, and you take the action. You know, you take the action, and the insight follows. You let somebody be a mess. You know, Jesus frequently let people be a mess. He didn't fix and save and rescue and spackle back together and enable them to stay crazy. He would say, you are very crazy right now. I love you, but I'm going to go for a little hike. And we'll talk later. And so to just do it, it's like, you know, I can probably answer any question that comes up by telling you about dance, but it's little by little by little. You take one action. You don't save the person this one time. They're out of money and they don't even have gas to get home. And you know what? You don't drive to find where they are to give them money to get home, because then they're going to run out of gas again. You say one of three things. You say, wow. Or you say, that sounds really hard. Or you say, well, I wish I could help, but I'm just really, really excited to see how you're going to make this work out, because I know you are. I know you are. So with everything, you take one step, and everybody, like with writing, I actually wrote a whole book about this. You think you're supposed to know what you're doing, how the plot is going to unfold, who the characters are, who the characters were, who the characters are going to be at the end of the book. You don't have to, you're not supposed to, and no one ever does. For all of you who are writers, the good news is that none of us know what we're doing when we sit down, and we are all blessed and cursed with equal proportions of grandiosity and low self-esteem. And you flail and you do one thing. You just do one thing. You say, well, I think I'm going to write the passage where Rosie goes to the parkade and sees the guy dealing dope. And then there are 37 voices in my head that will say, I don't understand what that gets us. I don't understand how that all ties together. I think maybe what we need to do is figure out what the hell we're doing, you know, and there are 37 voices, like a really bad jukebox, you know, and then they're like two voices, and one, they're just so internalized, and they're like, one of them says, well, I really like the way you tell that story. I heard you tell your brother, and I thought it was really trippy and kind of scary. I didn't know that what was going on. And then this other voice, it's like the way I would talk to you if you handed me your story, which please, please, please don't. But if you did, I wouldn't say, oh, Renee, for God's sake, this just sucks. This is terrible. And there's no plot, and I don't believe the kid. You know, I wouldn't do that. I would read it, and I'd say, you know what, Renee? There's a bunch of stuff in here that I really love. I don't think the first page works at all. And I think if it were my piece, I would start on the second page down in the third paragraph. That's how I would talk to anyone else but me. And so I that's that other voice. And so I start and I go, okay. And you don't ever believe that it's going to work. You know, you think the jig is always up and won't get another essay or book written and won't ever get the worry relieved, won't ever get free of nicotine, won't ever get free of this particular woman that is just so toxic. It's just not going to happen. So what's the point of doing this little thing? The point is it's the only way anything gets done. It's the way it gets done. You take the action and the insight follows. So the scariest thing that you can do is to say no. You start saying no more often. Now, the most important thing, then we'll go on to the next question, is anyone here over the age of 40 should never, ever help anyone move again. And I know some of you have, in your 40s, helped people move. And your backs hurt, didn't they? So this ties in with getting through the worry, is that if someone says, I am in such a pinch, can you help me move on Saturday? First of all, no is a complete sentence. So you could say, no. Or you could say, you know what, I can't help you move, but let me bring the crew some sandwiches at about, say, 1. And then you let them move because you have a bad back and you're old and you shouldn't help. You've moved enough people. By the age of 40, you've moved enough people. But in general, the more you say no, the better your life is going to be. You know, people talk about the big yes, and I said yes, and I didn't know what I was doing, so I said yes, and that's fine. But the more you say no, and the more you make yourself get less done every day, the more glorious and sweet and expansive your life is going to be. I really recommend that every single day you figure out one thing you've realized you're not going to be able to do. And in the morning, you take it off the list. You just say, it's not going to happen. You know what? It's going to be a good day. I'm going to get less done, and I'm going to get it done less efficiently. And that is the secret of writing, is that you get less done, you waste more time, you waste more paper, send a check to the Sierra Club, print out, waste time, go over it. Every single thing you learned as a child about writing or being a mother is it didn't turn out for me to be true in many cases. My mother believed she kept us alive by keeping a fish hook in our chest. And what she did was to keep a fish hook to the crazy part of us. And of course, anybody that actually wants to be connected to you by a fish hook is by definition crazy, right? So, I had to come to the realization that I wasn't going to keep Sam safe by having a fish hook in his chest, and that Sam had his own higher power and he had his own destiny. And his own life was going to unfold, sometimes based on choice and sometimes based on something invisible that we might all call different things. So that's my recommendation, is you try to just say, say you have a child, like an infant or something, and you want to go check all the time because you could become mentally ill and you need to check them, do a little real quick CPR when they're really sound asleep because they're like air plants, you know. They don't move at all. And so you just do a quick pump, get them breathing again, re-rhythm them. And so you say to yourself, you know what? This one time, I'm probably going to go again in 10 minutes, but right this minute, I'm not going to go. And I'm going to sit here and I'm going to breathe and I'm going to stare off into space. Maybe I'm going to say a little prayer. Maybe I'm going to go call someone who I know is really lonely and I'm just going to ask how they are, you know? And little by little, it's so amazing to see how people thrive when you stop doing your toxic worry and your toxic help and your toxic rescue on them. And you release them to the care of their own higher power and you surrender into the care of yours and you breathe. There's a person in the back there. And then and these people aren't getting... Wait. Right. See, they're loyal and honest people. And then we'll get someone on this side.
I know, Ms. Lamont, you said it for questions, but I just wanted to grab the mic to let you know you're one of the greatest writers, and it's an honor for me to be here this evening.
Oh,
thank you so much for breathing.
Thank you. Is there anybody over on this side? There's a hand.
I just wanted to hear about dancing.
Oh, dancing. Oh, thank you. Okay. And, you know, sometimes I get asked to come speak somewhere about faith, and sometimes I get asked to come speak about writing, and I can grab the exact same notes, because everything I know about writing or faith applies to the other. It's that you, and then it's going to segue into talking about dance. It means that you stop, you know, you stop. You stop this headless, unconscious rush to get stupid stuff done, that when you're 80, you're not going to feel like, God, yes, I'm glad I kept that car as clean as I did, you know? You're going to think, I wish I had danced. I wish I had sung more. I wish I'd learned to meditate. I always like to draw. You stop You flail. You make lots of messes and mistakes. You hardly ever know what you're doing. Really cool people hardly ever know what they're doing. You know, people, there's one writer I've heard of, Muriel Spark, the wonderful English writer who wrote Memento Mori, who felt that she was so plugged into God and to her own creative gift that she felt like she was taking dictation on dictaphones. Right? Now, to me, that just sounds so angry and aggressive. Right? It just seems like an act of hostility to even say that out loud. Like, if it's true, to say it. And no one I know does. You flail. You make messes. You stare off into space. You have to put aside work you've done. It just doesn't fit in. You don't need to know more than you do. Every single thing you need to know for anything, for how to be a parent, how to be a writer, how to be a seeker, how to be a spouse, it's in you. It's all inside you. And to move past from where you are, you don't have to go very far. You don't have to learn very much. It's a great system. However, unfortunately, many of the adults in my childhood forgot to mention this. And I was raised to be a perfectionist. And I was a high achiever. And I grew up feeling like I was on a tightrope wire, kind of holding my breath, because I was so afraid of falling or embarrassing the family, embarrassing myself, not being cool. And I just got good at being on the tightrope wire. And it wasn't until I got into recovery when I got sober when I was 32 that people encouraged me to let myself fall if that was in the natural course of events. And when you fall, here's the thing, it's 18 inches. The tightrope wire at its highest is 18 inches. And the miracle is that somebody will always, always come by, reach down, give you a hand, help you dust off your butt and get turned around. So, with faith and writing, E.L. Doctorow, the great novelist who wrote Ragtime and just so many wonderful books, he said, writing is like driving at night with the headlights on. You can only see a little bit in front of you, but you can make the whole journey that way. And I think it's true of absolutely everything. My father's version before him, about 40 years ago, not 50, 45 years ago, when my older brother was about 10 in California, in fourth grade, you study California history. You take the Sacramento trip. I study the gold mines and the Miwok and the Spanish missions and the whole gestalt. And you study birds. Now, I don't know why this is, but you study birds for about a semester and you have to have a report. You have a report due. It's your first real report because in third grade you don't write papers, really. It's your first real report with research and it's on birds. And my brother was a terrible student and he hadn't started the bird report. And it was a Saturday. It was due on a Monday. And we were out. We had this little one-room cabin. He had binder paper. He had those clear vinyl things you put your document, your illustrations into. He had good paper. He had colored pencils. He had books on birds. He couldn't start. And he just started crying. And he never cried. And my dad sat down with him, put his arm around him, and said, just take it bird by bird. So my brother would read about pelicans for 10 minutes. And then he'd write about pelicans, and then he'd draw pelicans, or he'd clip a picture of a bird out of National Geographic. And then he'd read about, you know, house finches, and he'd read for 10 or 15 minutes, and then he'd write about it, and then he'd draw a picture. And he got his report done. And I can honestly say, anything I've ever written that you like took forever to write, but I took it bird by bird. I first studied the pelicans. Then I wrote about the pelicans. This draft that I wrote, like people say, oh, you talk just like you write. This draft was probably 1,500 words, 6 or 7 manuscript pages, and it probably took close to 2 weeks. So I hope that gives you encouragement if you're a writer or an artist, is that it's little by little by little, bird by bird. So I just always sort of wanted to learn to dance because if you get invited to a wedding or a party, certain parties, I mean, it hasn't happened in 5 years, but it could, is the point. I could get invited to a party where there was dancing and then they play beautiful music and they play Frank Sinatra and they play The Way You Look Tonight and I can do this kind of 60s hippie tribal two-step stomp. And I really love dancing and I wanted to learn how to dance. Now, the hardest thing at all is to be as old, to be middle-aged. I'm 53. I'll be 54 next month. And to be willing to be bad at something. You know, that is the hardest thing. It's hard to, because most of the stuff we do, we're good at, because otherwise we wouldn't still be doing it, right? You don't normally keep pursuing things for which you have no gift, because you're not stupid. And you go, I'm no good at this. It's no fun. It makes me hate myself. You know what? I think no. So everything I do, most of the time, I'm pretty good at, you know? So Rory, my boyfriend, and I decided we would take dance class. So we started in June. We have these, both of us are very athletic, highly athletic. And he's very musical. And we sort of thought it'd be a breeze. It was like trying to get an elephant to ice skate. It was so strange, because the way you dance, I can't quite demonstrate because of the chronically late people in the overflow room, because I can't step away from the mic. But what you learn typically is foxtrot, because it's very easy and simple. It goes slow, slow, quick, quick. You step straight in front of you with your right foot. If you're the woman, you step straight in front of you with your left foot, and then you go quick, quick. Now, anyone could do that. You could all stand up and go slow, slow, quick, quick. For the life of us, we could not do slow, slow, quick, quick. And the dance, but the teachers are so incredible. And they go, no, you're really doing better. You're really doing better. And but we were so bad that the dance teachers had to protect other dancers from us, because we would bump into them or step on them. And we try to do slow, slow, quick, like when your arms are up too. And it's like trying to rub your stomach and pat the top of your head. It's really hard. But the thing is, we wanted to do it. And if you want to write, I can tell you no one cares if you write. You know, it's not in anyone's best interest that you start to write. No one in your family wants you to write. It's true. It doesn't help anyone in your family for you to want to tell the history of your life. I've always said anything that happens to you, you own. It's all yours. Whatever happened, if they didn't want you to write about them, they should have behaved better. But no one wants you to write. It's got to be an inside job. You have, it's a debt of honor that you make with yourself. You're going to do it. And we stuck with it. And week after week, we went back and we did slow, slow, quick, quick. Slow, slow, quick, quick. And for a while, the teacher would have to be like a bumper like they have on sails, those big rubber tires or something to keep the sailboat from crashing against the dock. And he'd be kind of moving and all around so that other people wouldn't get tripped up. And little by little, and then, you know, and then Rory would step on me or something, and then I'd just think, this relationship sucks. I have to get out of this, you know. Or else he'd say, you're not following me. I'm supposed to lead, and you're supposed to follow. And I'd feel like, God, men are such pigs, you know. I'm going to call Code Pink, and you know, like have a benefit. And, but you know what? We did it, and we did it week after week after week. And you know what? Now we can dance. Foxtrot, I could, if you see her, we could go all the way around the perimeter of the, we go up the aisles, back, around the aisles, back up here. And it would be not great, but it would be lovely, be lovely. And we can dance waltz and East Coast swing and West Coast swing, which is incredibly hard. We can do the merengue. We can do the cha-cha. And we do them all badly. But, you know, we've only been doing it since June. And so that's the story of my dance class. And I'm missing it. We have a Tuesday night group. And it's so motley, you know. It's just the motliest group of people. And some people drink before they come because they're so shy. And there's two people with Down syndrome. And they're really one incredible dancers. And then there's young people who are getting married who have to be able to do the first dance. And then there's a lot of people like Rory and me, and we always wanted to dance. And we're learning, you know, and it's slow, slow, quick, quick. And the next talk that I give on writing is going to be about slow, slow, quick, quick, and letting people help. You know, having people there that will help you with whatever it is your creative spirit is expressing in the world, just to have people there going, no, you're doing better. You're not hurting people as often. So, one more question. Okay. You, whoever you want, I'm not getting involved in this. Okay.
Thank you. Could you talk a little bit about relationship and if there's things that have carried over for writing and dancing and giving too much help and cutting things out of your schedule? How do you balance all that? And what do you think about how did you meet your boyfriend? Anything like that.
Okay. Well, I would say slow, slow, quick, quick. I think relationships are grad school. And romantic or, you know, marital relationships are grad school. And in recovery, we always say that once you get in a relationship, it's like pouring Miracle-Gro on your character defects. And and everything that you might have dealt with in your mid-20s but forgot to is suddenly up. So the thing to remember, I mean, I'm having a 6-year relationship, but I mostly haven't had great relationships because I like to be alone. I'm extremely odd, and I was addicted to this other part of the worrying, which was that I was addicted to tough cases. I was addicted to people that would help me recreate my family of origin so that I would have, like, I would know the base camp I was at because it was just like it was when I was 6. And in my family, I mean, the relationships for me meant, again, unlearning every single thing I was taught because my parents did not have a happy marriage, but they stayed together because it was the 50s and the 60s, and that's what you mostly did. And they didn't have enough money to separate. And so our house was like this weird little clipped pinter play, you know, where no one ever raised their voices ever, ever. I was 35 when I raised my voice for the first time, and it was at Sam, who was about an hour, you know, who was about 6 weeks old, when I just lost my mind completely. I had never shouted at another human being. And so what I grew up learning was no shouting. Shouting equals death. Shouting equals annihilation. Now, I always tried to find religious people because I always felt like I always knew that if I prayed, someone heard. I always knew I was here to discover the truth of my spiritual identity. I knew I was here. I kind of knew eventually I was a child of God and I was here to become big and juicy and messy and expansive. But I didn't grow up that way. So I had to learn. When I was young, there was a Catholic family who would take me to Mass. And the Catholics, they would shout at each other. It was so weird. And the mother would say something really horrible, and the father would get mad. And then the kids would cry, and the father would say, "You shut up, or I'm going to give you something to really cry about." And then everybody would cry, and the mother would be upset, and doors would be slammed, and the father would go crazy. And then you know what? It would all kind of be out. And about 5 minutes later, people would be kind of checking in with each other, and the couple would make up, and they'd kiss. It would be so weird. It was not nuclear annihilation. It was expression, and it was loudness. It was different. So I had to learn how to stop being good at what I'm best at. And what I'm best at is keeping secrets for people. What I'm really good at, having been raised around alcohol, is not seeing what's happening. And a lot of you I know most of you had parents who had a very, very healthy marriage and who had read up on child psychology and were able to just delight in you whether you were turning out the way they wanted you to or not. But around alcoholism, the child always learns not to see what's happening, because if you see it, you're doomed. You know, if you admit to yourself what you think is going on, there's no hope because you don't have any more control. You only have control if you don't admit it and you can pretend it's not going on. And so I had to learn to see what I see and to know what I know. I had to learn to know what I know, which has been awful. I hate it. And with Rory, one thing I like to do that you do in alcoholic families is you set traps for the person because you won't be real or honest with them or say, you know what? I feel really funny about bringing this up, but I just need to say it. I just want us to be really honest with each other. I don't do that. Instead, I set these traps for him to fall into, and I catch him in my tiger traps. And then I think, good, now I can get rid of him. Because it's intimacy is the scariest thing on earth. It's the scariest thing we do. That's why this culture teaches us so little about intimacy, because it's not supported. It's why you're supposed to get your surface right. Why you'd better try to keep your weight down. Why you'd better burnish and spackle your appearance. Why you'd better be somebody who's this way and that way and a value and comical under stress. And so the hard work is to start to be a person who's aware that she sets traps and doesn't often know what she knows, who does all these old things I did to survive as a child, but who has decided, like with dancing, to learn how to do intimacy. Because I honestly believe that's why we're here. But that intimacy for me always meant going over to the other person's, my hostage's emotional acre, and doing intimacy at them, you know, and then kind of tying them up so that they couldn't get away. And making them need me so desperately that they'd be crazy to even consider getting away. And what I've learned now is to do the hardest thing at all we do, which is the intimacy with ourselves. And I've needed a lot of help. And I've gotten a lot of help. And I tell people what's going on. And I discover almost all the time that, you know, it's a cliche, but when you're pointing a finger at someone, you've got three fingers pointing at you and none of them pointing up, you know, where there might be help, you know, in the mine eyes look to the hills sort of way. And so I have learned to do intimacy with myself, and it's amazing how much Rory's character has improved since I started doing that. And he has become a person who I don't feel like leaving all the time, because the person I want to leave, correct, fix, and can't stand is me. And so it's been a lifetime of learning to fall in love with myself and to trust my instincts and to believe that if I see something and know something, it's probably happening. I don't talk myself out of stuff anymore. I might not feel good about it. But so I learned to do that deep, radical, maternal self-care. And I became a person slightly less crazy. I became a person just well enough to do that tough, tough work of letting another person know you deeply and truly, your authentic self, not your performance art, not your package, just your human self and your divine self and your messy self and your outrageously beautiful self. I have all those feelings for myself. Sometimes I have them all within the same hour, and it's complicated. So I think it's also the second thing I would say, and then I'm going to just read something quickly and so you can go. The second thing, I think it's really helpful to learn to breathe. And I didn't learn to breathe until I was in my 20s, because in alcoholic families, it's best not to breathe, really, because that will put you in your body. And if you're in your body, then the whole chain of catastrophe starts, i.e., you start to notice what you're noticing. You start to feel what you're feeling. You start to feel that your heart is breaking. You start to feel your heart is opening. You start to realize you're not safe. You start to realize these people are crazy, you know, and the mistakes were made. So you don't breathe. And I couldn't breathe my whole life. I'd hold my breath. I breathed from the top of my throat. And to learn to breathe, breathing and plopping, you know, to plop down and to breathe is going to be the most spiritual thing I do most days. To stop the forward thrust that I did learn to do perfectly, beautifully. And instead to plop and to breathe. Because sometimes what happens is I start crying. It turns out I was really sad. That's how I was getting so much done. Turns out I was really angry. And that makes me really sad. And that's how I got so many things done. So plop and breathe. And, you know, there's a great line of the German mystic Meister Eckhart who said, if the soul could have known God without the world, God would have never invented the world. So it's all of this stuff that is the curriculum materials for the soul to find itself, to love itself, to express itself. I mean, how amazing when you're with somebody who's expressing this kind of radiance or bigness or self-acceptance. Like, it's just amazing. So if the soul could have known God without the world, God would have never created the world. Okay, I'm going to read you a library piece. I'm going to let you all go. We're going to be almost an hour. except for I can't think. Okay, it's called Steinbeck Country, and it's really not long. I promise. I promise. And then I'll see you in somewhere else if you want to say hello. I wouldn't shake hands with me. I'm a petri dish of filth and pestilence. But come say hi, and I'll show you my tattoo with the purchase of a book. And did I mention the tattoo really quickly? Oh, okay, I got a tattoo on my left leg, and I'll show you. I can show you from here, but then the people, the overflow people, will be bitter, as they tend to get. It's a Rose of Sharon, which is another name for Jesus, and it's also the name of the daughter in Grapes of Wrath, who's such an amazing creation. And on it, there's a stem, and the stem's is cursive writing, and it says, "Trust the captain, trust the crew." And it's a line from the scripture of Star Trek, the third book three. No, chapters, no, it's season three, and an American submarine gets caught off enemy waters, stuck down below on the bottom of the ocean. And finally, after everybody races around crazily trying to figure out what to do, Martin Sheen says, you know, no one knows more how to proceed than those people. And he says, let's just trust the captain and trust the crew. And all I have to remember is I know who my captain is, and we have maybe different captains, but I know who my captain is. I trust him absolutely. I trust him with my child's heart, because I think he is my child's heart. And I know my crew, which is my family, my brother, my guy, and my boy, and my couple of best friends, and my church community in recovery. I know nothing could happen, not principalities, not catastrophes, not administrations, not nothing, that they're not going to help me through. So I just, that is what reminds me and helps me to breathe. So I'll show it to you later if you stick around. Okay, Steinbeck Country. In Salinas, word went out. This is how many tribal stories begin. Word goes out to the people of a community that there is a great danger or that a wrong is being committed. This is how I first found out that the governor planned to close the public libraries in Salinas, making it the largest city in the United States to lose its library because of budget cuts. Without getting into any ugly political mudslinging here about whether or not our leaders are clueless, bullying, numbskull non-readers, which I mean nicely, let me just say that when word went out that the three libraries, the John Steinbeck, the Cesar Chavez, and the El Galiban, were scheduled for closing, a whole lot of us rose up as one to say, this really does not work for us. Salinas is one of the poorest communities in the state of California, in one of the richest counties in the country. The city and the surrounding area serve as the setting for so many of Steinbeck's great novels. Think farm workers, fields of artichokes and garlic, faded stucco houses stained with dirt, tracts of ticky-tacky housing, James Dean's face in East of Eden, strawberry fields and old gas stations. Now think about closing the libraries there, closing the buildings that hold the town's books, all those stories about people and wisdom and justice and life and silliness and laborers bending low to pick up the strawberries. You'd have to be crazy to bring such obvious karmic repercussions down on yourself. So in early April, a group of writers and actors fought back, showing up in Salinas for a 24-hour emergency read-in. Hold on a second. My sad 60s heart soared like an eagle at contemplating the very name, emergency read-in. George Bush and John Ashcroft had tried for years to create a country that the East German state could only dream about. Empowering the government to keep track of the books we checked out at bookstores or checked out at libraries or bought in bookstores, all in the name of national security. But the president and the attorney general hadn't counted on how passionately writers and readers feel about the world, or at any rate, the worlds contained inside the silent spines of books. We came together because we started out as children who were saved by stories, stories read to us at night when we were little, stories we read by ourselves in which we could get lost and thereby found. Some of us had grown up to become people with loud voices, which the farm workers and their children needed. And we were mad, Show a bunch of writers a sealed library, and they see red. Perhaps we were a little sensitive or overwrought, but in this case, we saw a one-way tunnel into the dark. We saw the beginning of fascism. A free public library is a revolutionary notion, and when people don't have free access to books, then communities are like radios without batteries. You cut people off from essential sources of information, mythical, practical, linguistic, political, and you break them. You render them helpless in the face of political oppression, and we were not going to let this happen. Writers and actors came from San Francisco and San Jose, from all around. Maxine Hong Kingston came from Oakland. Hector Elizondo drove up from Los Angeles, as did Mike Farrell. The poet Jose Montoya drove from Sacramento, which is 4 hours away. Alicia Valdez Rodriguez flew all morning from Colorado to be there. I drove down from the Bay Area with the Buddhist writer and teacher Jack Kornfield. When we arrived, the lawn outside the Chavez Library held only about 150 people, not the throngs we had hoped for, but the community was especially welcoming and grateful, and the women of Code Pink, who helped organize the event, kept everyone's spirits up. It's pretty hard to be depressed when activists in pink feather boas are kissing you. Many people had pitched tents on one side of the library where they could rest through the night while the readings were proceeding on stage. Can you imagine the kind of person who is willing to stay up all night in the cold to keep a few condemned public libraries open? Well, not me, baby. I was going home to my own bed that night, but I saw a bunch of my father's old friends who were planning to stay, people who have been protesting and rallying in civil rights and peace marches and for the environment since I was a small girl. People who had driven from San Francisco because they've always known that the only thing that keeps a democracy functioning is the constant education of its citizens. If you don't have a place where the poor, the marginalized, and the young can find out who they are, then you have no hope of maintaining a free and civilized society. We were there to celebrate some of the rare intelligence capabilities that our country can actually be proud of, those of librarians. I see them as healers and magicians. Librarians can tease out of our inarticulate individuals enough information about what they are after to lead them on the path of connection. They're trail guides through the forest of shelves and aisles. You turn a person loose who has limited skills, and he would be walloped by those branches. But librarians match up readers with the right books. Hey, did this one turn out to be too complicated? Then why don't you give this one a try? Inside the library were Hispanic children and teenagers and their parents and a few old souls. They sat in chairs reading, stood surveying the bilingual collection, and worked at the computers. These computers are the only ones that a lot of people in town have access to. The after-school literacy and homework programs at the libraries are among the few safe places where parents can direct their children away from the gangs. On this afternoon, people read to their children in whispered Spanish, and the air felt nutritious with it. As Barry Lopez said, sometimes a person needs a story more than food to stay alive. I went back outside. Poets of every color were reading. People milled around with anti-war placards. Libros sí, bombas no. Older members of the community told stories from legends, history, from their own families. Ferdinando Suarez stepped up to the mic and spoke of his 19-year-old son who had died not long before in Iraq. Suarez first spoke in English and then in Spanish, as he does frequently all around the country, and your heart could hardly beat for the sadness. Maybe in Oaxaca, children are still hearing the stories that the elders tell, but these kids in Salinas are being raised by television sets. They're latchkey kids. Their parents work for the most part in the fields and in wealthy homes. If you are mesmerized by televised stupidity and don't get to hear or read stories about your world, you can be fooled into thinking that the world isn't miraculous, and it is. The media attention brought in enough money, partly as a result of that day, to keep the libraries open for a whole year. You might not call this a miracle exactly, but if you had been at our emergency read-in, you would see that it was at least the beginning of one. a bunch of normally self-obsessed artist types came together to say to the people of Salinas, we care about your children, we care about your stories, and about your freedom. Something has gone so wrong in this country that needs to be fixed, and we care about that. Reading and books are medicine. Stories are written and told by and for people who have been broken, but who have risen up, or will rise if attention is paid to them. Those people are you and us. Stories and truth are splints for the soul, and that made today a sacred gathering. Now we are all saying, pass it on. So, thank you for being here tonight. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.